Hello. This is so much fun. We can take Zoom to all corners of the globe. Earlier today, we were in Stockholm, Sweden with Camilla Läckberg, and now we're in Sydney, Australia, or possibly a suburb. I didn't ask you specifically, with Anna Downs, who is British, but now lives in Australia and has written this crackerjack debut called The Safe Place. So welcome, Anna.
Thank you, Barbara. Thanks so much for having me. It's so exciting to be in Arizona this morning.
That's true. That's the other thing I forgot to mention. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon here in Scottsdale, but it's 9 o'clock in the morning tomorrow.
In Sydney. It certainly is. We're in the future here, Barbara. I've just dropped my children off at school and preschool. And so I'm fresh from the school run. And I've had a nice cup of coffee and ready to go.
Excellent. So when we say Sydney, I've been to Sydney. Tell me, what is Sydney? That's just sort of a giant metro area.
Well, I'm actually about an hour and 20 north of Sydney. So if you were to drive on the freeway just up from Sydney, you spend about 45 minutes on the freeway and then you come off and go out right to the coast. I live on the beach. So the name of the section where I live is the Central Coast. Okay. Yeah, so lovely little coastal community. It's actually getting much bigger now as people from Sydney move out here. Yeah,
which we've all seen as a consequence of the pandemic and isolation, is that people are doing that. So you're north of Sydney, but south of Brisbane, is that?
Yes, way south of Brisbane. Right. So if I was to drive to Brisbane from here, it would probably take me about 10 hours. Something like that.
Oh wow, that is way south. Okay. And then yeah. you're even further south from Cairns and the reef and all those good things. These are the things Americans tend to think about when we go to Australia. You know, we think Sydney, we think the reef, maybe not so much Queensland, or we go south to Melbourne through the Blue Mountains, Melbourne down to Adelaide and so forth. I think I wrote to you that I have a niece-in-law who's from Perth. From a Chinese family in Perth.
Fantastic. Yeah, so you've been out here a fair bit.
I have. I have not been to Perth, but my younger daughter and her husband have, and they think the west coast of Australia is truly spectacular.
I know, so I haven't been. So if had the pandemic not hit us, I would have been on a national Australian tour, and we would have gone to Perth, we would have gone to Adelaide, Cairns, Brizzy, Tasmania, we would have been to Melbourne, we would have done all of that stuff. And I was really looking forward to going to WA. Western Australia is supposed to be absolutely spectacular. And I will get over there at some point, but obviously not at the moment. I ain't going anywhere.
It wouldn't be too bad to go to Tasmania. We were scheduled to sail from New Zealand to Sydney for New Year's Eve, and then down to Tasmania and on to Antarctica this winter for our 30th wedding anniversary, but of course it has gone south. But I know people who spent time in Tasmania and think it's absolutely gorgeous.
I hear nothing but wonderful things about it. Yeah, it's supposed to be a gorgeous, gorgeous place to go.
So here we are waxing on about Australia.
I know.
Your book is not set in Australia.
No, it's not.
It rather begins in London. And I really like this, the idea, the safe place. You said in an article that I read by you, you'd always wanted to be on BBC Radio 4's Desert Island Dis. So what's that? Tell us what it is and then why it is you wanted to be on it.
Oh my gosh. It's funny. These kind of things that you grow up with as a kid that, you know, Desert Island Discs was so much a part of my life. I find it really strange that people might not have heard of it, but of course, you know, you wouldn't have done over there. So Desert Island Discs is a long-running radio show on Radio 4, and the premise is basically that the host invites a guest on, and they are, to all intents and purposes, a castaway. So you kind of pretend that you've been cast away to a desert island, and you're only allowed to take certain items. Now, you're not allowed to take anything that might aid escape, but what you are allowed to take is, I think it's 8 pieces of music. And the whole point of the radio show is that those pieces of music tell you or tell the listeners a lot about you and about your life. And they've had guests on, you know, they have all kinds of guests on. One of my favorite guests was, oh my gosh, Charlie Brooker, who does the Black Mirror series. He was a really interesting guest, and the way that his choices of music shed light on his inspiration and you know, what's kind of shaped him as a person, but also what shapes his art, is really interesting. But it was always playing in my house. We always listened to it, and it's still going. And that article that I wrote is basically my way of getting on Desert Island Discs. But I flipped the format, you know, for fun. And so it's not eight pieces of music that I chose in that article. It was eight books. So I think that's the one that you've read, isn't it?
Well, I have seen that idea in relation to books. You know, if you were cast away on a desert island, what's the one book or the four books or something that you would take? It's a bit of a variation. The New York Times book review has an interview with authors every week. And that's one of the questions they sort of zero in on. You know, what five books would you never part with? You know, what five books most influenced you? What three authors would you have for dinner? And
that's a good one.
It is. And so the idea, of course, is to sort of triangulate onto what the person being interviewed is like based upon all the rest of it. But a variation I saw on this in this interview was that part of the fun of the Desert Island Discos was to imagine a celebrity, because people are probably more interested in what a celebrity would listen to than an ordinary person. Mm-hmm. So if in fact you decided that you wanted to cast somebody into a really foreign setting and see if they can find their footing or lose it, is that part of the inspiration behind The Safe Place?
The major inspiration behind The Safe Place was, so the story follows a young woman who is offered a job working for and living with a very wealthy family on their remote but incredibly beautiful property on the Midwest coast of France. The point at which she accepts the job, she's in a bit of a cul-de-sac with her life. It's sort of falling apart around her ears. And as the story opens, she kind of loses everything that matters to her within about 24 hours. So she's in a bit of a mess. And she goes off to this wonderful job, and she loves the family, her employers that she's working for. It's a gorgeous place. The job's cruisy, and she thinks it's a dream come true. But obviously nothing is ever perfect. And so, you know, what at first appears to be the opportunity of a lifetime slowly unravels into something much more sinister. And the main inspiration for that was that I actually myself did do a job very similar. I worked as a live-in caretaker / housekeeper on a remote property on the Midwest coast of France. And I am very happy to report that nothing terrible happened there at all. Nothing sinister happened. The family that I worked for were absolutely gorgeous, and we're still friends to this day. However, the experience was, it really stuck with me. It was a very eye-opening experience, particularly in terms of living very closely with a family that I had not known previously. So that's kind of challenging, but it's also very eye-opening, and you become very close to people quite quickly. However, if you're working for them, there are professional boundaries that must stay in place, and kind of towing that line could be quite tricky at times. The other thing that was interesting about it was how isolated the property was. And because they were so wealthy, and they, you know, we didn't really want for anything on the property. You know, we had everything that we needed. So while we were there, and they sort of spent their summers there, so I'm talking, you know, 3 to 4 months at a time of the year, we just really didn't need to go off the property at all. I mean, we did, but we didn't have to. We only really went out for kind of groceries and to go to the market and things like that. And so that in itself was quite interesting. And I sort of, when I was there, I did start to think, you know, goodness, anything could happen here and nobody would know about it. There were certain times as well, because the family themselves weren't at the property all the time. Sometimes they would head back to London Or maybe they would go for a weekend somewhere. And I was actually doing that job with my husband. So my husband and I would stay on the property and look after it while they were gone. And, you know, every so often, excuse me, we'd wake up in the middle of the night. You know, when you're in your house and you wake up and there's a strange noise and you kind of, you know, you're sitting up in bed and your ears are pricking and you're going, what is that? But you know your house and you know the environment that it's in. So, you know, you can quite quickly figure out that it's probably nothing. But because we didn't really know the area and there was so much surrounding the property, you know, it was in the middle of all this woodland, but it was right on the coast as well. So they were kind of right at the property's edge. There were cliffs that went down into the ocean. So, you know, our minds were running wild in those moments. We kind of thought, goodness me, anything could be out in those woods. And we're here all by ourselves, so far away from any other towns. And there were also a few strange little things that happened that stuck in my mind. Like one time, a bat got stuck in our house, and it was flying around in the evening, and it got stuck behind a mirror, and it was kind of flapping behind this mirror, and this mirror was kind of shaking it. So, you know, ostensibly it was like there was some kind of ghostly presence in the house. It, you know, and like I said, your imagination starts running wild in those moments. So that experience, living and working for a family on their property, was the inspiration for the book. That was a real life experience. Of course, the other thing that inspired it, was the fact that I, like my protagonist Emily, used to be an actress. And the point at which I took that job and I went to live in France for a short time and do that job, my own life was kind of falling apart a little bit around my ears as well. And so that was the point really at which I started writing, was the idea of this young woman who is very uncertain about where she belongs and who she is and who she's going to be in the world, what she's going to contribute. She can't really manage her finances. She doesn't really know from one minute to the next whether or not she's going to be able to make rent or anything like that. And then, she kind of gets rescued by this family. And I just kind of wanted to explore those notions of identity and belonging. Those things also play out in different ways through the other characters. And, you know, isolation is a big thing as well. Actually, when I began writing the book, I'd moved to Australia here. My husband is Australian. And he grew up here on the Central Coast. And I thought, wow, you know, what a wonderful adventure. Yeah, sure, I'll move to Australia. Great, brilliant. And then it was a few years after we'd got married and we had two beautiful, healthy children. We had two children under two, though, which is quite a job. And I was feeling very isolated there and, you know, a little bit sure once again of who I was and what I would contribute, you know, outside of the children. And my identity was crashing a little bit. And I sort of found myself almost in the same place again, you know. And so all of those feelings were swirling around. And I needed a creative outlet again. I'd given up acting at that point. And so I just started writing one line at a time, and miraculously it became a manuscript. But certainly sometimes I think, I mean, it is autobiographical, but I look at people who write nonfiction and memoir and think how extraordinary that is for them to have such an incredibly clear perspective on their own experiences. Now, I'm not sure that I have that necessarily, but what I did produce as a result of trying to explore those feelings is this book, which I think reads a little bit like a dream that I had, you know, like you know, when you have a dream and you try and explain it to somebody and it feels very strange and weird and you kind of say to that person, I don't know what that means, how extraordinary. But in the telling of it, you suddenly start to realize that of course it means this, that and the other, you know, because it all feeds into your mindset or your emotional state at the time. And that's what The Safe Place feels like to me. It's kind of like the outward manifestation of my processing of all of those things and all of those experiences. That's a very long answer to a short question, isn't it?
It's an excellent answer. I would say a couple of things. One, you were not alone when you were in this remote. You had your husband with you. And, you know, then so there are a lot of crime novels, lots of thrillers, lots of romance and suspense, you know, which take a woman to some sort of situation like that. I always loved, back in the day, Victoria Holt wrote a book called Nine Coaches Waiting, you know, in which the governess, there she is in a chateau in France and isolated and the whole bit. And it's often about young women trying to find their power in, you know, situations where they are unsure of who anybody is and what their role is. And also, and I think very true in your book, there's a tremendous economic disparity. I mean, what you have is this young woman whose attempts to forge a career in acting have not worked in London. She's been to numerous auditions. None of them have worked out. She's feeling very uncertain about herself and her talents. And then she runs into a billionaire. And, you know, we have a lot of discussions here at the bookstore about fame and about, because we've watched an awful lot of people go from no fame to a lot of fame,
right?
And money with it. And we often talk, don't we, Patrick, about some people can withstand it and some people really cannot. But what happens is that that kind of money is almost like gold dust. You know, it drifts down on people and it creates a certain, I don't know what I want to call it. It you can't really treat them anymore, just like one of you. You know, there's that almost like a film or something, you know, gold dust, as I say, it goes over them. So here's this young woman with no earning power and, you know, no confidence in herself at this point. And she meets one of these gold dusted men. Mm-hmm. And it's almost going to be impossible for her to not to listen to his offer and not to accept it, whether she has any qualms or not. And then when she arrives, the family has that kind of money.
Yeah.
And, you know, the rich really are different. There's no question that things are easier, things are possible, that, you know, a person without resources or confidence can't do. So what you've got is some beautiful, flawed people and some very rich people. And then you've got this young woman who steps into that arena. And obviously that wasn't entirely your own experience, but I can see where you draw on your feelings. I also felt that you drew on your experience as an actress to block out the scenes. There's a very, you know, visual quality to what goes on. Do you think that's a fair statement?
I do. I think that naturally, having had so much experience in both theatre and television, and I didn't just study acting, but I also studied drama at degree level at university. So that involved, you know, not only things like history of theatre, but also film theory. You know, we had a whole year where we took films and broke them down and tried to figure out how they worked. We did a lot of playwriting. We did performance skills. We did all kinds of different things. So I think naturally, I do think quite visually. I think episodically as well. I know how to sort of deliver a certain amount of information quickly and effectively within a small scene, you know. So I think that's helped a lot. The other thing I think is the that old adage of showing, not telling. And I think, you know, if you're an actor, what you do is you interpret other people's words and you literally put them into action. So I feel like when I'm writing, I first see the scene and then I kind of drop myself into it. You know, like the little guy on Google Maps. I kind of drag myself over and drop myself in. And then it's like I'm walking around and hearing and touching and feeling and talking with the characters. And that's what it's like when you're an actor. You are taking someone else's words, someone else's situations, a fictional character, and you embody it. So that really helps for me. And I love it when people say that they can see how, you know, that they think that the story is really visual, because I think, like, I'm really proud of that, but I also really enjoy that in other people's books as well. I love it when I can see things really unfolding in front of me. I mean, I read really widely, so I also really like a lot of introspection. You know, it's not like it has to be action, but I do really admire it when writers can really show me something unfolding in that visual way.
Well, you're used to scripts, so I'm thinking that, you know, oftentimes it's difficult for a novelist to become a script writer because you have to, it's a different story platform. You have to strip things out. You have to leave room for the actors, the whole bit. But it must be interesting if you're accustomed to scripts, you know, to then write a novel. And I have worked with one author who is a very good screenwriter whose novels are just too spare. Because, you know, he's accustomed to the actors and the sets describing things or, you know, filling in. And you have to pull more words out of him to make it a novel. But yeah, we certainly know, Patrick and I have both talked to authors who have tried to write scripts of their own novels, for example, and that's too hard to go the other direction, you know, to pare it down. So, but it's interesting that, you know, with that experience, reading scripts and working with scripts, you know, that then you would come to writing a novel and bring that skill set with you.
Yeah. I think, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? It really, that they are so different. And I think that it's often assumed that if you've written a novel, you could write the screenplay. But of course, they are such different art forms. They're such different disciplines. I've always been a hugely voracious reader, and I think that my fascination with the novel form has always been there. My passion for it has always been there, and I don't know. I guess for me, the language and, you know, the trying to find ways to accurately describe the way that you feel was something that I really wanted to do. So it wasn't just a matter of trying to show a scene. I really felt that need to use the language to express some of those feelings that you get when you're an actor and you're on stage and you're trying to summon some kind of emotional you know, so you're trying to summon ways to express what you're feeling emotionally. I think that quite often I've used language to do that. And certainly at drama school as well, you know, writing did come into play a fair bit. You know, if we were studying a character or a play, quite often we would either be asked to write a kind of off stage monologue or something that happens outside of the action. Or we might be, we did a lot of work about trying to explore and identify characters' actions and motivations, objectives, their inner rhythm, things like that. And we did that through words. So we would spend ages, you know, listing different motivations, desires, fears, objectives, just lists for our characters all the time. And so if we were in a scene, we would be able to pick out particular words as keystones almost. Do you know what I mean? So I think that there was definitely that opportunity in acting training to explore language. But yeah, I think it's just that I'm just a hugely passionate reader that I didn't find it too difficult to access language as a tool for expression.
Before we stray too far away from scripts and television, yeah, I'm an enormous admirer of the work of the late Reginald Hill. We were friends for a long time. And I really love his D.L. and Pascoe series. And so I was interested I've watched it. So I was interested to see that you actually played a role in the D.L. and Pasco series. And so tell me a little bit about it, because I think the two lead men were fascinating. I think that the D.L., didn't he recently die?
He did. He was lovely. Warren. Yeah, he was such a kind man. He was so lovely. Yeah.
He was wonderful as D.L. He had all those. But what role did you play and did you enjoy it?
I did. It was probably one of my favorite TV shows that I ever did. I was in a two-part special. The episode is called Dead Meat. As I say, it was a two-part. And I guest starred as a character called Katie. And poor Katie was a slightly down on her luck zookeeper. And she was a zookeeper who, and this is a spoiler for anybody that's going to watch the episode, but she gets involved with an organ trafficking ring, and she gets in a lot of trouble with them. And the final throes of the plot to kind of Katie being locked in a, she gets kidnapped and she's locked in a cage with a snake and all. It was obviously highly realistic, gritty drama. I had such fun doing it. I got to, one of the scenes I did was discovering a dead body in a tiger cage, and that, you know, we were there with a real tiger, and I had to carry a tray of dead meat in order to provoke this reaction. So what the reaction that they wanted was obviously me as the actor to see the dead body and scream and run away, but they wanted the tiger to really kind of, you know, have some kind of a reaction. So the tiger was quite hungry. It was his feeding time. And I was to approach the cage, do my reaction. But like I said, they'd given me this big tray of meat. And so they wanted me to throw the tray and the meat at the bars of the cage, so the tiger would throw his weight at the bars of the cage, and all. So it was about five takes of just, you know, I did not have to fake a second of that scream and that reaction, because I'm walking up and I'm thinking, oh my god, and then I throw the meat and the tiger just leaps against the cage and I'm like, ah! So when you watch the scene back, it's quite funny when you know what's really going on. Well, yeah, that was a great job.
I will keep that in mind. You know, it's interesting. That's the other point, is that dramatization, you know, it's a different platform than a book. And so some of the things in the TV of D.L. and Pasco are not in the books. For example, Peter Pasco and his wife, despite some disputes, stay married forever. But in the TV, she becomes really quite an antagonist. And I always found that to be interesting, but it was more dramatic, you know, if that were true and there were conflict in it. So I think anyone who's really passionate about a series in books has to go with whatever variations may occur in the dramatization. They often don't quite follow along. And we hear a lot of that from readers who are going, mm-hmm. But we're the Outlander bookstore. We're really lucky that Diana Gabaldon lives here and we have been her home.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So we've been together. She was a customer before she began to write. And I still remember the day she walked into the store carrying a copy of her first book and said to me, I've published a book. And I went, oh, okay. right. But where was I going with that? Oh, I think she's been extremely fortunate, and she will herself say that the video, the dramatization of the books has hewed quite closely to the books themselves, despite the inherent improbabilities in the basic concept they have gone with it. And so she's been really fortunate, and her experience has been fortunate. And then we know other authors who really not had such a good time, and that's just how it goes. But it's a question that comes up with virtually every writer, is that people want to know about, you know, is there any chance of a movie or television, and who would you cast to play so-and-so? And I always wanted to say to them, you know, the writer doesn't actually have much control over any of that.
No control at all. And I think as well, like you said, it's so worth bearing in mind that they are such different animals, you know, books and film or TV adaptations. They're just completely different. And sometimes, like you said, you do look out and you'll get a adaptation that really, really does feel like it's just been ripped from your mind. And that's a lovely thing to see. You know, I just recently, the TV adaptation of Sally Rooney's Normal People was a bit like that. You know, it was sort of like walking through my memories of reading the book. But there are others where, you know, you feel like they've gone in a really crazy direction. Sometimes it doesn't work so much and you feel a bit disappointed. And other times it's like they've just created this completely different story, and it works and it's wonderful and it's brilliant because it's teased out so many different elements of the story and of the characters. But yeah, I think ultimately it's such a different animal. And I think maybe if I was a screenwriter, if I had any screenwriting experience, and who knows, maybe one day I'll explore that. But, you know, if I did have that experience, maybe I might like to have something to do with an adaptation. But really, because they are so different, I think it's always better as an author if you can just hand it over and then crack on with your own next project and just see what they do with it, and then, and you know, let it go and just enjoy, see if you can enjoy what they come up with.
So your book is not Australian. I mean, it's, you know, as we've discussed, set in London and in France. Have you had a chance to read and meet any Aussie authors? And, you know, we know a lot of them here. And I'm really looking forward. I'm going to be talking to Michael Robotham in August, who's one of my...
Love him.
I think one of the best mysteries I ever read, the name of which I never can remember, was the one set in London where the young woman appears to be pregnant.
It's such a good book. I read so fast. I could not put that down. It was brilliant.
He's a wonderful writer.
Yep.
Carrie Greenwood, Miss Fisher Mysteries have been such a success. I noticed that Derva McTiernan, thank you. She was here in the fall. We had some four Australian authors who got a grant from the Australian, and they came to the store.
That's right. Crime Writers on the Run, I think it was. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Was fun. Sulari Gentle, who I think is amazing.
And, yeah, she is.
And two gentlemen whose names are going out of my head. Anyway, it was wonderful. But I see that Dervla has just signed a big contract to do, I can't remember what, but I read it and I thought that was great. But
yeah, she's...
I was just going to ask you if there are any Australian authors that you have read that you would recommend.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the lovely thing I think about the book industry on a, you know, in a global sense is that there are such... You know, it's a very warm, friendly, supportive industry, no matter where you are. I think the crime genre in particular, crime and thrillers, there's even more of a sense of community. I really noticed that across the board in, you know, the UK and the US and in Australia, you know, crime writers are incredibly supportive of one another. I don't know that the safe place is necessarily straight up crime or thriller. I think it's got a lot of different genres in there. But I almost, you know, again, across the board, people have been really supportive and really lovely, particularly here in Australia. I mean, comparatively, it is quite a small market. And, you know, it feels like quite a tight, close community, you know, which coming into it, I think initially feels quite intimidating because you sort of think, oh no, are they going to be nice to me? You know, first day of school. And they just, everybody has been so lovely and so supportive, so welcoming. I haven't yet met Michael Robotham. I really hope to one day. I really, really like his work. There is a writer out here called Christian White. If you haven't read his books, they're really worth a look. They are just wonderful human stories, but really thrilling as well. Another writer called J.P. Pomare. He's a New Zealand writer, and again, his thrillers are very fast-paced, very exciting, but with real complexity and depth at their core as well. Now, Jane Harper, obviously, you know, she's kind of leading the vanguard a little bit. She's just brilliant, and obviously her stories are very, very much set in Australia. And really explore the landscape as well, which is brilliant. They're very transporting. Another writer called Chris Hammer, who writes, again, quite similar to Jane Harper in that they are very of their setting, you know, small town Australian stories, you know, quite often about small towns that hold secrets. And his protagonist is a journalist, so it has a slightly different flavor than the police procedurals, but I read, like I said, I read really widely. One of my favorite writers of all time is Leanne Moriarty, and I guess, you know, in some circles she might be called a crime and thriller writer in some ways.
Yeah, but I like Kate Morton's work tremendously.
Kate, oh, she's fantastic.
She really is. We've been fortunate that Jane Harper and Candace Fox.
How could I forget Candace? She is wonderful. Well,
and Sarah Bailey, I think, is really an interesting Australian writer. They've been here. Sulari Gentle's been here. Dervla's been here. Michael Robotham has been here. But that was when he lived in, I think, in the UK. It was moving back. Gary Disher. Yeah, Gary.
Gary Disher. Yeah, he's just had new book out. Yeah.
So we've been really fortunate. And I hope, you know, one of the positives of this pandemic, if there are any, is that we can connect with people that were not necessarily going to come visit us, at least on any regular basis. Now, good news for you, you might be able, in fact, to meet Michael Robotham as soon as I set that up.
That would be amazing. Wouldn't that be amazing? Yes, I really, really would. I really, really would. That would be incredible.
All right. Oh. I will sort that out then.
That'd be amazing. You might have to put up with me fangirling a little bit at him, but
you know what? Michael would really like that, so that'd be all right. Let me see if Patrick has any questions over here or comments. Do you have anything you want to forward?
Yeah, let's see here.
This is Patrick, who's doing the Facebook while we're talking.
Hi there. Let's see. Susan asks, are there any authors who inspired you when you first started writing?
When I first started writing. So, I mean, I'm sort of both proud and embarrassed to say that The Safe Place is my first ever attempt at writing a book. So when I first started writing, I think, you know, I was reading a lot of Leanne Moriarty. Also, Stephen Fry, his books are really interesting and really compelling. And I remember reading one of his just before I started to write and thinking, I would love to kind of do a similar thing that he does, that his books are very kind of page turning and pacey, but they're very funny as well. And I do like books that inject humor, dark humor, into sort of sinister situations. I read immediately before I started to lay words down for the first time, I read Elizabeth Gilbert's Big Magic, which is a really great sort of companion read for anyone who wants to do something creative. And it doesn't have to be writing, it could be anything at all. But anyone that wants to do something creative but is maybe frightened of failing, or thinks that they, you know, oh no, I couldn't possibly do that. You know, I'm not a writer, or I'm not a dancer, or I'm not a sculptor. But, you know, of course, we all have that capacity. And what that book does is really demystify the creative process and kind of makes it seem very possible, while also you know, it also says it's completely magical and it's wonderful. And actually there are so many elements to creativity that we can't explain. And it just, it kind of happens, you know, like where do ideas come from? Who knows how we form ideas and how we put them down, and the connection between the person that creates something and, you know, its audience, be that some, you know, somebody at an art gallery or a member, a literal member of an audience or a reader, you know, that conversation, that dialogue, that kind of energetical exchange is a magical thing. So that book was amazing, very, very inspiring to me. When I read that, I was like, actually, yes, I could do this. I can do this. I mean, some of my very, very first literary inspirations were things like the Point Horror series. When I was a teenager, I loved those, Christopher Pike and R.L. Stine and all of those. And I was obsessed with Terry Pratchett as a young girl as well. So I think, there are lots and lots and lots of different inspirations that come from all over the place. And I am never without a book on the go. So I'm always reading constantly. And I always try and read slightly out of my comfort zone as well. I try not to stick to one particular style, because I think you can always get something from somewhere. You know, you can always get something out of something. Even if you don't think you're going to enjoy it, you'll get something from it.
Good for you. That takes a lot of discipline. It's way too easy to just read, you know, sort of comfort reading all the time. It's good to challenge yourself. Patrick, yeah. Anything else?
Just the million-dollar question, which is, what are you working on now?
Right.
Okay. I'm working on a second novel. It's not anything to do with The Safe Place. It's a completely different story. I'm still working on the first draft, not far off finishing, and it's a story. I'm exploring parental fear and the dark web and tech. So it follows two women, two separate points of view. They are 3 years apart in terms of their timelines, and they are living on opposite sides of the world. So one's in the UK, one's in Australia. And both of these women are raising teenage sons who in some way or another have become involved with the dark web and have kind of unhealthy obsessions with tech. So on one level, it's a story about mothers dealing with raising sons. It's also a story about how parents these days, particularly around sort of my age, you know, we grew up without the internet, but yet we are raising children that will, you know, we're trying to guide them in a world where tech is completely we can't do without it. It's integral. And so we are trying to advise them and, you know, release them into a world that perhaps we don't fully understand. I think we embrace tech, but I think there's a lot of fear surrounding it as well. There's a lot that we don't yet understand. But it's also about a trend that took place in the an internet trend that took place in 2017 that was around YouTube vloggers making videos of they were unboxing videos. They would order mystery boxes from the dark web, and these mystery boxes would be purchased from online marketplaces, purchased with Bitcoin, and they would be delivered to the house, and they would contain kind of strange objects that seemed to be maybe evidence of some kind. There were things like flash drives and burner phones and think, you know, what looked like drugs or strange photographs. And you know, the whole sort of mania around them was who was sending them and why. And these YouTube vloggers actually, you know, that they got quite a lot of attention from these videos. So in my story, one of these teenage sons is a YouTube vlogger. He's only 14 years old, but he's gotten involved with these mystery boxes. His mother takes away his devices, puts a full ban on their use so that he can no longer order them, but the mystery boxes keep coming and they start to contain items from the family's life and from inside their house. And so, dun, dun, dun.
Okay.
I'll leave it there.
Yeah. Oh boy. That sounds fascinating. Wonderful. Well, we're delighted to hear. I think, you know, every time we talk to a debut author, as Patrick says, the $1 million question is,
what yeah.
Right. Because, you know, if you really enjoy a book, you want to think that the author will produce something else that you will also enjoy. It's a different dynamic than when you're talking to somebody who's on book 11, you know.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm in this for the long game, and I love writing. I love the process of it. I love getting up early and sitting in the chair and putting the words down. So I can't for a second imagine that I won't carry on. I hope this next book will be a kind of similar vibe as The Safe Place. I hope that people will enjoy that as well. I have to say that a few early reviewers have kind of thrown out some comments about maybe a sequel or a prequel to The Safe Place, because there are a lot of unanswered questions at the end, and that's deliberate. I really enjoy an ambiguous ending, and you know, I enjoy a book that leaves me with questions. So I don't know, who knows? That's kind of got the cogs in my brain whirring a little bit as well. So yeah, who knows?
Well, since you're just starting, you've got all kinds of places you can go. So
yes.
Thank you so much for spending time with us. It's really been a pleasure. And I will be in touch quite soon.
That would be wonderful. Yes, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you, Barbara. Thank you so much for having me in your fabulous shop in Arizona. I'm so delighted.
We are delighted that you could join us. And we wish all of you who are watching this a very good evening. Thank you for joining us as well.